Today's Tay Show will be on Case 26 in the Muang Khan. Case 26 is entitled Two Monks Roll Up the Blinds. When the monks assemble before the midday meal to listen to his lecture, the great Hogen of Seryu pointed at the bamboo blinds. Two monks simultaneously went and rolled them up. Hogen said, one gain, one loss. Mumon's comment, tell me, who gained and who lost? If you have an eye to penetrate the secret, you will see where Seryu Kokushi failed. However, I warn you strongly against discussing gain and loss. Mumon's verse, rolling up the blinds, the great sky is open. But the great sky does not come up to Zen. Why don't you throw them all down from the sky and keep your practice so close that no air can escape? I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job this morning in the Zendo, in the virtual Zendo. You know, everybody was sitting so still. It's just wonderful to see that kind of determination and that kind of concentration. And even though it may be challenging at times, you know, your legs get tired, your back gets tired, and so on. You know, every sit, every moment of every sit, you're entering into deeper and deeper samadhi. And it's a kind of purification of body, mind, and word. You know, if you do this for a while, it doesn't take long. You feel differently when you begin that purification process. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you enter samadhi, it's different. It's qualitatively different. It's a different state of consciousness. And it's purifying and liberating. You know, you can be caught up in all kinds of worldly concerns, you know, and fretting about this and that. And after a couple of days of sesshin, it all seems so unimportant, and also unimportant. And this purification process takes place one breath at a time, one sit at a time. But, you know, over a couple of days, you begin to be, you know, transformed, really liberated. So many of the things we worry about are not that important. You know, people talk all the time, you know, there are people who are involved in sort of pastoral work, you know, rabbis and priests. And it's a cliche of those people who are working, say, with the dying, right? That, you know, the cliche is nobody on his deathbed or on her deathbed said, oh, I only wish I'd spent more hours on the job. You know, people generally don't say that. You know, what they generally say, why wasn't I more, they don't quite put it this way, but they often say, why wasn't I more awake? Why did I fret about things? And all our lives we do that. You know, I can remember there was a kid in elementary school, I think I was in the first grade, and I went to York Elementary School in Baltimore, Maryland, and it's York Elementary School still there. I Googled it the other day and it's still there. It hasn't been torn down. And I remember the neighborhood, all these Baltimore style row houses abutting this elementary school. And I used to walk, I lived near Lockraven Boulevard, if you know Baltimore. And I used to walk to school every day. And I remember, you know, when I first started school, there was a kid in our class named Bill. And Bill was everything I wasn't. You know, I was kind of a shy, awkward kid. I was pudgy, And I wasn't really a cool kid, right? And Bill was just, he was taller than almost anybody else in the class, and he dressed really differently. He dressed in a cool way. You know, I thought his style was like the cool kids you saw on TV or in the movies. I think he wore a jacket to school, and he had like a striped shirt. He looked very together. And I remember just wanting him to be my friend, you know, and making overtures to him and just getting rebuffed, you know, and it really got me down. You know, I tried to be liked by Bill, you know, and I would try to hang out with him on the playground and sometimes we would play dodgeball. I don't know if you ever played dodgeball, but and I'd want him to choose. I'd want to be on his side. You know, I would get chosen, but I would make some mistake. You know, I would miss the ball or drop the ball or something, and then it began to really bother me. I couldn't sleep. You know, and then I remember once I went up to him and I said, "I wish you could be my friend." And he said, "Well," he wasn't a nice guy, by the way, Bill. He said, "Well, you need to give me something." And I said, you know, he said, "What do you have to give me?" And I said, "Well, I have a jackknife," and I didn't have it in school, but I brought it and I gave it to him. And when my mother found out, she was furious. You know, she said, "You've got to get that jackknife back." And then I thought, oh, that'll be so humiliating, you know, and then he'll never like me, you know. So, you know, I used to lie awake at night and worry about this, you know, worry that Bill didn't like me, you know, or that I realize now how insecure and lonely I was. You know, tried to bribe this guy into being my friend, but it's so unimportant. You know, I remember it, you know, it's part of my karma, you can say, but it's, I realize who cared, who cares about Bill, you know. But all so many things in our life are like that. They seem hugely consequential, when they're happening. And then like 6 months later, it's like, oh, who cares, right? Who cares? You know? Now, look, there are things that really matter. You know, if you lose your job or you have health issues, those are important. You know, I'm not belittling those or denigrating those, but you know, often we get caught up in things that are really not that important. And when we come to Sesshin, you know, we realize sometimes, you know, how trapped we are by our ordinary mental habits, our ordinary perceptions, and how we waste our time on things that are so unimportant, right? I mean, I'm sure it's easy to see these in childhood, because we've sort of outgrown our mental frameworks, right? Hopefully. But the process of being naive never stops. You know, we continue to be imprisoned by these ridiculous perspectives, you know, all our lives. And it's so hard to get out of that. So coming here to Sesshin is really important. It's really, there's something inside you that wants to be free. You know, it's interesting. Yesterday, I was talking about how the emptiness is not what we think it is, right? That we might, you know, people in our culture, in the Western world, we think of emptiness as like nothingness, right? It's like nothing. My life is nothing. And we think of emptiness as, you know, basically negative. Western philosophy, there's a rule that goes back to Plato, and it's that something is always better than nothing. Something is, whatever it is, something is better than nothing. And it's just like everybody says that, right? And, you know, for us, nothingness is just the worst, right? It means, you know, the life amounted to nothing and so on. And I was talking about the fact that this is basically like profound misunderstanding, or I think I was talking about this, I'm not sure, but let me say it now. You know, this is like a profound misunderstanding of reality. When we start meditating, we begin to experience these spaces between our thoughts and our perceptions. And as we meditate more and more, you know, our awareness of those spaces becomes more clear, and our experience of those spaces becomes more sustained, right? So, you know, if you're watching the breath, it's a big struggle just to focus on the breath. And you have all these thoughts, especially on day one of Sesshin, right? You have all these thoughts that get in the way. And every time you have a thought, you have, generally speaking, you have some kind of an emotional or karmic reaction to the thought, you know? So if you left your workplace and there was a conflict there, you know, on day one of Sesshin, you sort of rehearse the conflict in your mind, and then you find yourself feeling that anxiety again, right? You know. So it's such a struggle just to tear ourselves away from that and begin to focus on the breath. And eventually we get to a place where we achieve this one-pointed attention on the breath. So it's like a big struggle leading the ox, being the ox herder and leading the ox of the mind to focus on the breath. You know, it wanders this way and it wanders that way. But eventually we pull it forward and we force it to walk down the breath road, right? The road of the breath. And, you know, we're thinking, I'm really getting somewhere. And then all of a sudden, you know, basically, you'll have this moment where everything goes blank, you know? And at first it's just this little thing. Sometimes people have a profound experience of this. I talked about the fact that I just had this accidental experience of deep mushin when I was doing some house sitting, you know, long ago. And I didn't even know what it was. I didn't connect it to my Zen practice particularly or to my focusing on the breath. But, you know, when you do focus on the breath, eventually the breath is going to disappear. And as I said yesterday, you know, this is true for anything you focus your attention on. And this is a clue that our understanding of the world is false or distorted by our mental habits. You know, we read out or exclude the moments of emptiness. When we have them, we look past them as quickly as we can. But, you know, as we do Zen practice, we begin to have those experiences of emptiness more and more. You know, so you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching the breath, and all of a sudden you notice, maybe just quickly, your mind goes blank. And then what is that all about? And you're back to the breath, you know? But, you know, the more you try to focus on the breath at some point, the more often you get into, and like I often tell people, look at the end of your breath. So I'll say, follow the breath to the end and tell me what you see. And people will say, well, I follow the breath to the end and my mind becomes blank. See? So, but eventually, if you keep practicing, you'll notice that that blankness is not just at the end of your breath. It's basically interspersing every sensation and every thought you have. So it's breath, or breath, thought, pain in leg, breath, thought, pain in leg. That's not really how things are. It's breath, emptiness, breath, emptiness, breath, emptiness, breath, or pain, emptiness, thought, emptiness, see? So there's like a kind of oscillation between something and nothing. And this is, as they say in the sciences, I'm not a scientist, but they say this is non-trivial, right? This is really important. You know, we don't look at those moments. We screen them out mentally. We sort of walk past them, but they're tremendously important. And it takes a lot of mental training to have the stability of focus to begin to notice them. And for a long time, it's sort of hit or miss. You know, you're ensnared in a long train of thought, and then all of a sudden there's a blankness. But eventually, you know, you get there, if you pay attention, you get there fairly regularly. And it, by the way, it's one of the reasons, if this hasn't happened to you, it will. You know, one day you're going to be working on a koan. You're going to come into Dokusan and you're not able to remember your koan, right? This has happened to people, right? I mean, it's happened to me. You know, I'm focusing on this koan for 4 days and I go into Dokusan and the Roshi says, "What's your koan?" And I can't remember. My mind is blank, right? You know, and it's like, what's wrong with me? Well, nothing's wrong with you, actually. That's, you're in a deep state of concentration now. So you know, this emptiness, so-called, that we experience in when we can stabilize our minds and slow them down sufficiently, we in Zen call Mushi, mind of emptiness. And it punctuates or intersperses our moments of sensation or thought, so that really it's a kind of on-off situation, right? That's closer to reality, or at least it's a more aware understanding of reality. And I said yesterday that, you know, our experience of the world is distorted because we only see half the picture. We just get the sensation, the thought, the memory, the sensation, the thought, the memory. We don't get the sensation, the emptiness, the thought, the emptiness, the memory, the emptiness. And what we call emptiness, or what we call shunyata, or zeroness, or mushin, is like the glue that holds everything together. It's the connecting principle, right? The invisible connecting principle. And that is puts the world together. It gives us a whole picture, or it gives us a more complete picture. So, you know, eventually, if we keep meditating, the character of our experience of emptiness itself is going to change. It's going to change. Because emptiness is really like the background or the foundation for everything we call form. So form and emptiness are like, form is like foreground and emptiness is like background. Now we don't notice the emptiness because we're like fish in the water, right? And this is often, you know, like fish probably aren't aware that they're in the water, because they're immersed in water. Everywhere they turn is water. You know, I don't know if you ever have this experience, but on about the second day of Sesshin, usually sometime in the morning, I suddenly have this, you know, this image of water, like that crystal clear water, right? And this is like, this is what we call emptiness, right? It's the medium in which all of these little fish that we are swim. And we don't notice it because it's invisible, but it's absolutely crucial. It's like water to a fish. You know, we swim, we're like fish meant to swim in the great ocean of Mu, right? And we're not even aware that the ocean of Mu exists. But you know, a lot of Zen practice is being able to move from something into emptiness back and forth until we begin to have a more complete picture of reality. But, you know, it's not easy to see reality because we cling to all of these misunderstandings and we have emotional investments in the way we see the world, right? So, you know, the Buddhist teaching is, the Zen teaching is that we're fundamentally awake. At the core of your consciousness is enlightenment, right? This enlightened consciousness. It's this luminous consciousness. But why don't we access it? Why can't we access it? And especially if it's like the water we're swimming in, if it's like water for fish, why can't we, like, how do we become aware of it? See? So, you know, the way we become aware of it is by experience, is by undoing our karmic obstacles. It's like you can't directly see it. You have to see it. You have to discover it by taking things away. You could say taking things away. So we have to undo what we think and what we believe in order to come into contact with this fundamental reality. So the way we do this in Zen, well, there's different ways to do this. Let me just say that one way to do this is just to sit quietly and to begin to notice that something's missing in our life, actually. You know, most people come to Zen because they feel something is missing in their lives, you know. They feel like they don't know what it is. You know, it's like something made you come to Sesshin. And if somebody said, well, what are you practicing Zen for? You would say, I'm practicing Zen in order to become enlightened. And then if somebody said to you, well, what's enlightenment? You wouldn't be able to describe it, right? But there's this sense of absence, or something's missing, or something's not right with our lives. And I think that's what brings some people to the cushion. You know, yesterday I talked about the fact that the Mumonkan and the Heikigan Roku both start with emptiness, because both of those teachers thought that emptiness was sort of like the most important thing for our practice. But you know, there's another collection of koans called the Book of Serenity, and the emptiness koan is number two. The first koan in the Book of Serenity is the Buddha descends from his seat. See, that's interesting, right? Well, I think it's interesting. The Buddha descends from his seat, and what it says is that the Buddha is on his seat, and then he comes down off of his seat, right? It's like the Buddha is on his throne or in his place being the Buddha, and then he comes down, and then he's gone. And I think, you know, I think this koan is really an interesting way to start the koan collection called the Book of Serenity, because it's saying, you know, we all feel something is missing in life. Something is missing. We have a craving for wholeness or for connectedness, and it's often not there in our lives, right? And I think that's what brings us to Zen. It's one of the reasons people, you know, get trapped in things like alcoholism, or, people can take things like heroin because they feel so cut off from life. They feel so, it's like they're thirsty for something, but they don't know what it is, right? And so they go down confused or bad roads, right? You know, so sometimes I think our own dissatisfaction can be a way to practice. You know, the things that make us unhappy actually can lead us to insight, And this is actually very important for koan training, right? I mean, so for example, a lot of koans direct us to things that we would prefer not to deal with, the things that cause us anxiety or even suffering, right? And this is actually the only way, it seems to me, that we can really free ourselves from our misconceptions and become aware of, this water of Buddha nature that surrounds us. So anyway, this koan is about two monks, and basically a very famous Zen master named Hogen of Seryu comes to this monastery, and he asks two monks to roll up the blinds, right? And he says he's about to give a Dharma talk like this, Taisho. And it's too dark. And he says, roll up the blinds. And two monks jump up at the same time. They run over and they roll up the blinds. Right? These are like those bamboo blinds that roll up, right? So they both pull the cords and the blinds roll up at the same time, like simultaneously two sets of blinds. And the abbot said, and the guest lecturer says, you have got it and you missed it. See, it's like if you saw it, roll up the blinds, two monks jump up. They're identical monks. I mean, all monks probably look pretty much the same. They both jump up. They both pull the blinds and the blinds roll up, right? And the teacher points to one and says, you got it. And he points to the other one and said, you missed it. See? So basically, this creates like a contradiction, right? This creates, it's like, that's not fair. I saw these two monks. Why does this guy get it and this guy doesn't get the praise, right? Why is this guy faulted and this guy's praised? And it doesn't make any sense. It offends maybe our sense of justice, or there's something we're not seeing here. See, there's something we're not seeing here. So the koan is creating like a contradiction, or it's speaking to our experience of contradiction. So maybe, you know, if you want to work with this koan, you sit down on the cushion and you say, one way to process this koan is to say, one hit, one miss. One hit, one missed. Or one hits, one missed. See? Or one's right and one's wrong, right? One's right and one's wrong. Or one hits and one misses. Hit and miss, hit and miss. And you say hit and miss, hit and miss. You know, and after a while, you know, the koan has the effect, if you try to work it out intellectually, you're just wasting your time. So you could say, well, you know, in the grand scheme of things, none of it doesn't matter. You know, he's just testing the monk's humility or something like that. Who knows? But if you sit with the koan and you internalize the koan, you know, it begins to resonate with things that have happened to you. So maybe, you know, you applied to go to college. Your favorite college was the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And you worked incredibly hard to get into University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And you worked on the newspaper, the high school newspaper, and you were in the band, and you stayed up late night after night to keep your GPA up, right? And then you have a friend who also was interested in going to UNC. And your friend's grades weren't as good as yours, right? Or maybe they were, you know, maybe they were. But the friend wasn't in the band. The friend didn't, you know, write for the student newspaper. And the friend applies to UNC and gets in and you didn't get in. You know, and, you know, this sense of like unfairness or injustice is something you might have put aside, right? But you start working with the koan and all of a sudden you realize, you know, you realize, I'm, you know, that hurt me so much. You know, I so wanted to get into UNC Chapel Hill and I didn't. And I felt so humiliated and I felt so unworthy. And that bastard, you know, that guy in the class who was looking at everybody else's answers got into UNC. And, you know, it all comes back, flooding back. You know, this is kind of how koans work, right? It's like you Now you're stuck with your suffering and you're stuck with your small-minded perspective and so on. And, you know, we want to push them aside, you know, and say that has nothing to do with enlightenment. You know, that has nothing to do with the oneness of it all. But the way to get to the oneness of it all is through this stuff. There's no other way, right? Or I would say there's no other way. So you know, you sit with the koan, and instead of making you feel better, it might make you feel worse. You know, now all of this, now you have to come to terms with, you know, your resentment or your anger, or and coming to terms doesn't just mean seeing it. You know, you sit with it until it stops producing these powerful emotional responses, right? And, you know, maybe you've been angry about this for 10 years, or maybe you feel, you know, this was the beginning of a kind of a cynicism in your life where, you know, you just think the system is, you know, basically unfair, and you're kind of mocking about everything. And whenever anybody's successful, you at whatever they set out to do, you feel angry and cheated. And so it's very human. You know, we all have stuff like that going on. And again, you could say, well, what does that have to do with enlightenment? You know, the idea is we're supposed to go to Sesshin and we're supposed to sit down on the cushion and the teacher's supposed to tell us something and we're supposed to have this wonderful experience. But, you know, we can't become aware of Buddha nature except indirectly by clearing away our obstacles. So it's like cleaning, you have to clean your way to that clarity, right? You have to clean all of the junk away. And the way we do it is with koans, because we don't know what our junk is, right? You know, koans speak to us on a deeper level than our conscious mind. If somebody said to you, what are the biggest obstacles that are keeping you from enlightenment? You know, the ones you would be able to put your finger on are not the ones that are keeping you from enlightenment, right? The ones that you are keeping you from the enlightenment are the ones you've hidden from yourself, right? That's why they're keeping you from enlightenment. It's like people who have anger issues, for example, you know, they can't just say to myself, oh, I have to stop being so angry. I need to cultivate a loving mind, right? You know, that's very unlikely to work. You know, if you have anger issues, it's probably for reasons you don't know, you don't understand. You know, so there's actually koans that deal with anger issues. You might be given a koan that would, and maybe this one would produce anger. You know, maybe you'd be thinking about that poor monk who pulled up the blinds and did his best job, and damn it, you know, he didn't get praised. He got condemned by that arrogant, you know, so-and-so. And then you might feel yourself burning with rage, right? You know, that would be a good response to the koan, actually. And you might go into the teacher, and the teacher would say, well, what's happening with the koan? And you might say, nothing. You know, I keep thinking about this, I didn't get into UNC. I'm sorry, I'm not able to focus on my koan today. But actually, that's the koan, right? You know, your big mind is speaking to you. It's telling you something. It's saying you have to work through this in order to be more awake. And so, you know, you sit with your sense of disappointment, your sense of, you know, being devalued and so on and so on. And it all hurts. It all hurts, you know. But after a while, it stops hurting, you know, and you become clear. You become clear. It's like, it stops clinging to you, or you stop clinging to it. And that's very hard, very hard. You know, it's easy to imagine going to Tibet and meeting, you know, some lama in some temple, and that's easy, easy. The hard part is cleaning our house, you know. You know, you might feel this sense of outrage or this sense of injustice or disappointment. You know, you were supposed to be the guy who did it all, who got into UNC and became valedictorian. Instead, you know, none of that happened. This is my life. None of that happened, right? And there's all this pain. But you know, you sit with it, and after a while, it stops triggering these responses. It seems impossible that this could be so, right? Sometimes the injuries go pretty deep. But then, you know, it stops triggering these responses, and you're actually calm and clear. You know, yeah, I didn't get into UNC. I really wanted to, but I didn't get in, right? And you're not angry anymore, and you're not hurt. It just happened to you. It just happened. See, I mean, when we talk about the Buddha, we often use this phrase, anuttara samyak sambodhi. Anuttara means enlightenment without remainder. Remainder means karma that we're dragging around with us. And we're all dragging karma around with us, all of us. We don't know what it is because we've hidden it from ourselves. And it's why aren't we enlightened? Why don't we look around and see the water of enlightened mind everywhere as we swim around in it? Because of our obstacles. You know, so the Buddha is supposed to have been Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. All his obstacles were cleared away. So when things happened to the Buddha, they just happened, right? There wasn't any blame or anger, or it just happened. This just happened, right? So things just happen. Things just happen. And we assign to them good or bad, you know, qualities. We assign to them, we call it victory or defeat. We call it, you know, humiliation or, you know, whatever the opposite of humiliation is. But none of those, that's all just fantasy. Things just happen. Things just happen. So for the Buddha, things just happen. You know, he actually says, in the sutras, when the Buddha is describing his awakened state, he says, I saw that what happens, happens, and what doesn't happen, doesn't happen. And that might seem like a small reward, but what he means is, things are no longer attaching themselves to me in a way that prevents me from being awake. See? So this koan is actually, you know, like a door into enlightenment. It's helping us to identify the things that cause us suffering and make us unintelligent, you know, make us unintelligent and unaware. And every time we go through this process, see, it's like having a dirty window and you're cleaning a little bit more off the window. And each time you clean a little bit more, you know, finally the window's clean and you look out and it's like a completely different, my gosh, I never knew that was out there. You know, there's a beautiful forest out there. So you know, the thing is, we don't realize how dirty the window is until we start cleaning it up. And the koans operate that way. And if they didn't operate that way, you know, we would actually never wake up. And it's true. People do have accidental enlightenment experiences. So, you know, there are people who, you know, go to Sesshin for a couple of years and they have this earth-shattering, you know, experience. But, you know, actually, that doesn't liberate them, you know, because they still have all these mental habits. And often it's the case that those mental habits eventually just completely obscure the insight they had. This is actually the case. So I was thinking about this the other day, last night, as a matter of fact, because there was a guy in our Zen group in Seattle who had this amazing, he had only been practicing for a couple of years, and he had this this what we would call a Daikensho experience, a great awakening experience. And he was a movie producer, and he made a little movie about his Zen practice. And anybody who saw the movie who understands Daikensho would say, oh, he's had Daikensho. And then, you know, years later, I came out here to New Jersey, and I went back to see my Zen friends in Seattle. And I said, whatever happened to so-and-so? And, you know, it was sort of like he quit doing Zen. He had his wife was this wonderful person. She was this, they had a bitter divorce, you know. It was like he actually kind of lived, I don't know where he is now, but, you know, it was like there was a lot of wreckage in his path, you know. And I think, you know, he didn't clean up, you know, he didn't keep cleaning. He thought, well, there I'm there. And then he didn't see his mental baggage. So, you know, another way to put it is that, you know, this master's treatment of these two monks seems so outrageously unfair until we see the whole picture. It's like the missing emptiness is necessary to complete the picture. When we supply the missing emptiness, it's no longer an outrage. It all makes, it's just obvious. So, if you haven't done this koan yet, hopefully we'll have a chance to do it. And it's likely to help a lot. When the monks assembled before the midday meal to listen to his lecture, the great Hogen of Seryu pointed at the bamboo blinds. Two monks simultaneously went and rolled them up. Hogen said, "You've got it, you've missed it." See, you've got it, you've missed it. One more comment. Tell me, who got it and who missed it? If you have an eye to penetrate the secret, you will see where Seryu Kokushi failed. See? So the teacher failed, maybe. However, I warn you strongly against discussing gain and loss, right and wrong. So it's not about that. It's about working through our obstacles. Mumon's verse, rolling up the blinds, the great sky is open. But the great sky does not come up to Zen. Even the sky is not as high as big mind. Why don't you throw them all down from the sky? In other words, get into your mushin and work through your obstacles and be free. And then just let them all go. And keep your practice so close that no air can escape. So that's what we've been doing, sitting in deep mushin. Really excellent, excellent practice here.